Okay, there's just a few latecomers. It is actually more than sold out, but as usual, some people don't turn up at the beginning. But welcome anyway to the ICA for this evening's event, An Anatomy of the Bionic Body, which is actually the last in a series of events on technology, which has been programmed with the support of PlayStation. The aim of this evening's event is to look at the convergence between biology and technology. And after the talk, you're invited to have a look at a demonstration in the Brandon Room next door, where not only have we got Steve Grand's robot, Lucy, which we've all been dying to meet since he came to give a talk here last year, but also some computers to look at, one which transmits smells over the net, and another which allows you to feel virtual objects. In the chair tonight is Daniel Glaser, who's our scientist in residence, and in his other real life, he's a senior research fellow at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience at UCL. So I'll hand straight over to Dan to introduce the other speakers and kick the evening off. Dan.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks to everyone for coming. So we've got three speakers tonight, and the format for the evening will be that I'll tell you who they are, and then they'll each give you about 10 minutes to tell you why they're here and what they intend to talk about with each other. We'll then have a discussion up here for a bit, and then we'll broaden it out. I'll say already, although I'll repeat it later, that I'm going to be completely brutal when it comes to questions, so keep them very brief, and then we can get more stuff in. Okay. The order of the speakers, the first is going to be James Geary, who's an editor for Time magazine in London. He's written a book called The Body Electric, and he's going to tell us about some of the interactions between bionics and biology. The next person to speak will be Steve Grand, who describes himself as a digital god in this job. I think he means in the creative sense rather than in the one who should be worshipped, but I guess you can work that out for yourselves at the end of his talk. And his interests include artificial life, and he's the inventor of the Creatures game or system or lifestyle, which some of you will be familiar with. And our third speaker is Brian Eno, who's a difficult person to introduce, I think. He's, I think, originally a musician, and I hope part of what he's going to tell us about is how his ideas over the last few years have brought him towards the community of artificial life and notions of bionics. If you type Brian Eno and cybernetics into the internet, you get as many, you know, sort of 10,000 websites. In other words, he seems to be interlinked with almost any concept that you throw at Google. So in that sense, he's very appropriately part of this panel, as any other panel, I guess. One of the chapters of Steve's book begins and ends with a description of the last lecture he gave at the ICA. And I guess it's fair to say he complains of the reception that he received here as opposed to the reception he gets in other places. And his worry, I think, was that people were treating his views about artificial intelligence and artificial life in a very sceptical way, and they saw it as being a rather threatening thing. And they scared you witless, and apparently you scared them witless as well from the way you described it. So I thought I would look on the Time website of James's book and find that there's an internet survey. The question asked is, should brain-computer interface technology be used for anything other than medical applications? And this is a way, really, of judging opinion about whether the kinds of things we're talking about are dangerous or not. And you'll be pleased to hear that 87.5% of the respondents think that, yes, it should be used for other than medical applications. Although you'd be disappointed to hear that there are actually only 8 respondents at all. 87.5% is 7 of them. And I was 1 of the 8. So I guess, right, so everybody else apart from me is very positive about the topics. So without further ado, I'll start off. We've divided ourselves roughly into a trinity, so there's going to be some stuff about body, bionics, then there's going to be some stuff about mind, and then there's going to be all the rest, which we're calling loosely spirit. So, James Geary.
Thank you very much. I would like to just outline a few ideas about the intersection between biology and technology, and to give a few examples to demonstrate how it's actually taking place now, and then hopefully raise a few larger questions that could be addressed later on in the discussion period about artificial life, certainly the relationship between reality and virtual reality, and is there actually really a difference? Norbert Wiener in the 1940s and 50s, he was an important computer pioneer, and he's the inventor of the field of cybernetics. He said, render unto the computer the things which are the computer's, and render unto man the things which are man's. What I've tried to show in the book is that it's becoming increasingly difficult to tell the difference. It's becoming increasingly difficult to tell the difference between where a computer or where a piece of technology ends and where man or a human being or the biological person begins. What's taking place now is a sort of a dual progression. On the one hand, human beings are implanting technologies into their bodies. They're implanting computers and computer chips into their eyes and their ears, various parts of their bodies, to extend, enhance, and in many cases repair their senses. But at the same time, computers are being given senses. Computers are being given bodies. And you can see one of the computers with a body afterwards, Lucy, Steve Grant's robot. And with these sensory abilities, computers are increasingly becoming, well, the possibility to develop a mind, to develop a relationship with their physical environment that computers never had before. So I think in many ways this may seem like a startling development or a shocking, scary development to have computers implanted in your eye or even in your brain or some other part of your body, and the whole idea of cyborgs has become very, very popular thanks to ideas like films like The Terminator and things like that. But in fact, technology has always been an extension of the senses. The telephone or the telescope are, the one is an extension of the ear, the other is an extension of the eye. So technology has always been a way for us to increase the reach or the power of our senses. And what's happening now is that instead of having the devices on the outside of our bodies as part of our physical external environment, we're now taking them on the inside of our bodies as well. But the idea, the goal, is the same: to extend, enhance, or repair our senses. I think the most obvious applications are the ones that are always the first to be applied in terms of new technology. Military, those are always the ones we hear last about. Entertainment and medicine. I just want to give a few very quick examples of some of these technologies so you have an idea what the kind of research that's actually going on. There's, I think at this point, there's about 6 or 8 people in the entire world who have a computer chip implanted in their eye or in their optic system. And one of these people is a 63-year-old Belgian woman, and she has a disease called retinitis pigmentosa, which in which the light, the cells that are sensitive to light in the human retina degenerate, and a person becomes gradually blind. Now, the upside of this particular disease is that without a retina, your eyeball cannot receive light and can't send it to the brain. But the optic nerve in this woman's brain is still functioning. So if the retina were working, it could still transmit signals to the brain. So what she has is a computer chip implanted around her optic nerve, and this computer chip is linked to a video camera that she wears in a little, it looks like a really unattractive bathing cap, actually. It's a little plastic device that insulates her scalp against shock, but it has a little video camera and a transmitter, and she goes to a little laboratory in Brussels, and there's a specific type of screen which has live pixels embedded in various shapes. So you have the shape of a table or the shape of a chair, and as she looks at these shapes, the video camera registers the pixel and sends a signal to the video camera picks it up and receives the signal from the live pixel in the object. This is then transmitted directly to her optic nerve, which sends the signal along to the visual centers of her brain. As a result, this woman is completely blind and has been for several years, but as a result, she can see basic shapes and colors again. Now, the idea behind this kind of technology is to have these kind of pixels embedded in objects in the physical environment. When you come to an intersection in many places in London, you feel on the pavement there, the sort of little rubble bumps in the sidewalk that they're there because that's how blind people know they're approaching an intersection. With this device, you can have the live pixels embedded in either a street lamp or a street sign or in the sidewalk itself, which the user of this device, the blind person, walking down the street would see it, and that's how they would know that they're coming to an intersection. It's a sort of a form of electronic braille, but a kind of electronic braille that becomes implanted in the environment, and users of this device would be able to see, thanks to the implant in their optic nerve. And the same kind of technology is being used in other parts of the eye as well, where there's still healthy retina cells that can be boosted by the same kind of chip that functions there. So this is one example of how the technology is actually being implanted in the body. There are other devices which can project images directly onto the retina. There's no need for a screen like this one behind me. With a device called the virtual retinal display, you can have whatever you want actually projected directly onto your eye by a laser beam. And this device is implanted in a pair of glasses, and it could be a live video camera that's taking in the scene before us right now, or it could be linked up to the web, and you could be surfing the web. You could be wearing these glasses. I could be wearing these glasses now and be watching a rerun episode of Friends, for example, or I could be checking my email at the office, and the images would be scanned directly onto my retina by this virtual retinal display, which is essentially a television camera that scans the image directly onto your retina, just as a television receives transmissions by building up the image pixel by pixel. This device essentially paints an image directly onto your retina without the need for a screen. So these are two examples of the way the technology is in one case becoming part of our body, but in another case is enabling us to enhance or shape the way that we perceive the world. One of the things you could do with this virtual retinal display is edit your visual environment. For example, if you are offended by billboard advertisements, you could program this device to recognize billboard advertisements, and that whenever you passed one, it would automatically edit that image out of your field of view. You could replace it with pictures of your family, for example, so that every time, well, maybe that's a bad idea, but you could perhaps replace it with something else then. You could replace it with, and we've seen this on in sports, where you can have an advertisement. Depending on where you're viewing the sporting event, you can have an advertisement that's directed to your particular interest or your particular occasion. Now, perhaps the ultimate interface is a direct brain interface, and this is where you go directly to the source, the brain itself, and implant a computer chip there. Now, this is already done in human beings to help people with Parkinson's disease. A computer chip is implanted in the area of the brain that causes the tremors from which Parkinson's suffers, people with Parkinson's suffer. But the patient, him or herself, can actually manipulate the device, turn it on when they feel a tremor. The computer chip sends an electronic signal into that part of the brain, and it disrupts the signals from that part of the brain and stops the tremor. It's a very, very effective way to combat this aspect of the disease. It does, however, involve pretty serious brain surgery, in which a computer chip is implanted very deep in the brain. Now, there's work going on in the United States to implant these kind of devices in monkeys. And what the monkeys are able to do is to actually manipulate either virtual limbs or virtual senses or robotic limbs by thought alone. And what happens is the computer chip is implanted in the area of the brain that controls voluntary movement. So when I reach out to pick up this glass, a split second before I actually perform that action, my brain sends a signal to the rest of my body that essentially, hey, watch out, he's going to reach for that glass, get ready. It's essentially sort of similar to what you do when you start up the car on a cold morning. You pump the gas pedal a few times to get the engine primed, and that's essentially what's going on in the brain. Now, these chips are able to pick up that signal and anticipate the movement that the monkey is going to make, for example, reaching out to grab a banana. An experiment was conducted last year in which two monkeys who've been wired up this way, when they reached out to grab a banana, the robotic arm was connected to the computer chip in that part of their brain. The robotic arm moved at the same time. So essentially, these monkeys had three arms. They had their two biological arms, but they also had a robotic arm, which was operated by the same signals that operated their biological arm. Now, imagine the possibilities that this could have. The work going on now is to train the monkeys to operate the robotic arm without having to move their own arm. In other words, just by expressing the thought, I want a banana, and get the robotic arm to do it. You could have a robotic arm or a virtual arm on the web, or an entire virtual body on the web with which you can control basically through your thoughts alone. You could also have various limbs scattered about the world, actually, or scattered wherever you want. One of the experiments they did was to hook the robotic arm up through the internet to the monkeys in North Carolina, and the robotic arm was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And as the monkey in North Carolina reached out, the robotic arm in Massachusetts reached out at exactly the same time to grab the banana. Now, this is very far from any kind of application in human beings, but it is the, as I said, the ultimate interface. And what it indicates is that the senses are not confined to biology alone. In other words, the neurons that make up our brains and the various cells that make up our body are not the only materials out there that can interact with the world and that can respond to the world through senses. Now, I think this is a good intro to Steve's work, because he is in fact building a robotic orangutan who has not only a body but various senses and various ways to interact in the world. And I think the final thing that I want to say is that what we have come to regard as virtual reality, the things that we see inside our computers and the games that we play inside our computers, this kind of technology will bring that that world out of the computer and into our physical world, and will also take us inside the computer into the computer's world. And I think there the relationship between virtual reality and reality and artificial life and life will begin to blur. And in fact, soon we won't be able to tell the difference at all. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay, Steve, you've been introduced.
I saw the work at exactly the opposite ends of the spectrum to most of the things that James describes in his book. It sounds derogatory, but most of those things are to do with making people more like machines. And my work is to do with making machines more like people. So I work in artificial intelligence, which is a hugely complicated subject with loads of misconceptions, and I need about an hour and a half just to get into it, but I've got 10 minutes. So all I can do really is give you some kind of context for the work that I do. And of course, the first thing to say is that AI is hard, and we haven't, fundamentally, we haven't a clue how to do it. We've been doing this kind of stuff for 50 years now, and I've personally been doing it for half of that time, and frankly, none of us have a clue how to make intelligent machines yet. But when you think about how to try, where do you start? Essentially, you've got a choice between two options. Either you've got to emulate the brain, or you've got to emulate the mind. Now, these aren't the same thing, of course. It's true that minds come out of brains, but the mind has a kind of logic all to itself. Otherwise, thousands of psychologists would be out of work now. So one way you could approach the problem is to forget all about those messy neurons and things and just try and concentrate on the logic of thought. And 99% of all the work done in AI has taken that approach, and almost all of it is wrong. The fundamental assumption was that this logic of thought, the process of thought, is also the same thing as pure logic. The Greeks used to have dinner parties and discuss all syllogistic reasoning and all this kind of stuff. And then in the 19th century, George Boole figured out an algebra for handling logic, and then Alan Turing developed some of the principles of the computer based on that. So there's always been a strong correlation between what computers do, which is carry out logical operations, and what people assume brains do. And of course, brains don't do anything of the kind. We never use logic when we're really thinking. We only use logic to defend what we've thought, either to ourselves or to other people. But so fundamentally, I think it's a complicated issue, and I get into terrible trouble when I say this to AI people, but I think it's a bit of a dead end trying to tackle the problem just from the mind point of view. You just don't know what to go on. You don't know what building blocks to use. If you pay no attention to the structure of the brain, it could be that brains are the only kinds of system that can be intelligent. So there's always been a sizable minority of AI people who worked at the other end of the scale, and they say, okay, so what we need to do is emulate the brain. And in computer terms, that's fundamentally very different. In the case of emulating the mind, there's a direct correspondence between what a computer does, carry out logical operations, and what we presume thought does. In the case of trying to emulate the brain, it's very different. You use the computer as a kind of substitute material, through which to sculpt things. And 25 years ago, when I started thinking about these things, nobody understood what that meant. But these days we have computer graphics artists who are used to dealing with virtual materials, and I think that idea of using a computer as a space to build things is a little more commonplace. So you can use the computer as a space to build neurons and biochemicals and that kind of gubbins, and then plug them together to try and make brains. But most of the people who studied this stuff took one look at the 100,000 million neurons in the human brain and said, solve that for a lark. Let's go out and make worm brains instead. So actually most of the work on artificial neural networks is fundamentally based on what very simple animals' nervous systems are like, what invertebrate nervous systems are like. And by worms, I mostly mean things like the little microscopic nematode worms that crawl around in your eyelashes. Very, very simple things, a few dozen neurons. So most of the work in artificial neural networks has gone that way, gone for little worm brains, and there's been some success, and probably the first real applications for this kind of stuff will come out of these very simple invertebrate neural systems, because little worms can do some smart things with a dozen neurons. But it's got limited scope. Worms aren't very smart. Most of the ones I know aren't, anyway. And there's something fundamentally different, I think, about their nervous systems compared to machines like us. So I'm interested in us. I'm interested in higher animals. It's hard to explain. Several times during the course of evolution, I think nature stumbled on a clever trick for how to make nervous systems. And that clever trick was always something to do with finding new kinds of building blocks. So you imagine a time when everybody made their little model houses out of clay. And then somebody in Denmark figured out that you could make little bricks out of this clay and put little bubbles on the top and holes in the bottom, and you've got Lego. And now you've got Lego, you can make houses much more easily and more quickly. And I think this sort of thing happened several times in evolution, invertebrates and invertebrates. And it was particularly noticeable in the line that led to us, when the cerebral cortex evolved, where the cerebrum is, the biggest part of our brains, and the cortex is the thin layer across the top of it. And there seems to be a building block structure inside there. It's rather like rather like languages. If you invent written language, and all you're doing is accounting with it, which is perhaps what the first written symbols were used for, you maybe only need half a dozen symbols, and you can say everything you need to say. But then when you start to discover the power of that approach, you need to invent more symbols to deal with more ideas. And you keep on adding symbols to the language, and it gets more and more complicated, and you end up with Chinese. And 1,000 different symbols for 1,000 different ideas. But at some stage in the evolution of written language, some people invented the alphabet. And the alphabet is a fundamental simplification of the problem. Once you've got a small number of symbols in an alphabet, you can mix them in different sequences and produce a vast range of ideas. And in a sense, Chinese is an evolutionary dead end, and even the Chinese have now got simplified Chinese, and a lot of them have to deal with English because of the internet and so on. So I'm very interested in this building block structure. What is it that's going on in the clever trick in the cerebral cortex of our brains that enables that fundamentally blank sheet of material to organize itself into something that can do sums or think about what to have for lunch or control muscles and all the other things that the cerebrum does. I've just got one more slide. That's fair enough, you know, it's another hard problem. Where do you start? Now obviously there's thousands of people working on the problem of how the cortex works, and they're neuroscientists. And neuroscience is making a huge amount of progress these days. But I decided to take the other approach because I'm not really a scientist, I'm an engineer, and I like to build things. So I figured I needed a robot. And that's Lucy. In fact, I'll show you Lucy. Sitting down here with a bag on. I'll switch her on, but I'll warn you now that she hasn't actually got her brain with her at the moment. she's going to behave in the same way as you would if you were decerebrated and had your cortex removed. Why a robot? Why tackle it this way? The first thing to say, I suppose, is she's just a tool. I'm not trying to make some kind of sophisticated android here. Well, I am trying to make some kind of sophisticated android. I don't expect to succeed at making a sophisticated android. All I'm doing is trying to use Lucy as a focus for thinking about the problem. And for several reasons, one of which is that you can't bluff physics. Any idiot can come up with a theory of the brain and then write a best-selling book on it. And just sort of wave their hands here and there about, neural Darwinism is the solution, except, you know, it sort of does these things and we don't quite know how. But you can't bluff physics and you can't bluff a computer. If you can't explain the problem to a computer, then you've got it wrong. So there's a lot to be said for actually trying to build something, because only then do you face up to the real problems that you have to tackle. The other reason to build Lucy is that intelligence needs complexity. Most robots have two wheels and a couple of bump sensors and maybe an infrared sensor on the front. And I often wonder what it would be like for me if I had two wheels and a couple of bump sensors and an infrared sensor. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be intelligent. It's very hard to be smart when you've got such a limited body. So I've gone to some lengths to try and give Lucy a full range of senses, on the principle that the kinds of correlations in the environment that intelligence thrives upon are subtle and complex, and you need a broad range of senses. And then the senses themselves are important. If you're looking for inspiration about how the brain works, then you've got to bear in mind how our senses work, because they co-evolved. The human eye is not remotely like a television camera, and our muscles are not remotely like electric motors. And because our senses and our brain evolve together, you can guarantee that everything the brain does relies on the kinds of data format, the kinds of behavior that our senses use. For example, the pictures at the bottom of that slide are the closest I can get to what vision looks like. for us. You know, if you could take the picture on the back of our brain that's coming from our optic nerve, it wouldn't look a bit like the scene that we see outside. It would be tremendously fuzzy around the edges. There'd be a huge over-representation of the very middle degree or so of your visual field. So my nose starts to look really big when Lucy looks at me. And the maths that the neurons in our retina do on the image means that what you end up with hitting your brain doesn't look remotely like a picture. But already I'm gradually discovering that there are advantages in doing it this way, and there are things that I didn't think of, like scale invariance and the ability to recognize something no matter how far away it is, that might fall out of the fact that our eyes work this way. So, you know, maybe it's wrong, but it was at least worth trying to give Lucy a good range of the senses. So she only has the one eye, poor love, mostly because I couldn't afford two cameras. And she has proprioception. She knows where her arms are and how taut her muscles are. And her muscles, even though they're electric motors at heart, they can go loose and floppy. There's quite a complicated system to make them behave like real pairs of muscles. And she has virtual hearing based on how our auditory cortex might work and the bits in the bottom of the brain that deal with hearing. She has vocal tracts, so she has virtual lungs and has to breathe in before she speaks. And all you get is this nasty beeping sound. Anyway, I've better move on. I just want to show you something else, because it just want to show you a piece of software that came out of an early experiment. Because partly it leads into Brian's pitch, and partly because it's pretty, and this is an art thing. So, you don't need to draw many conclusions from this, but this is a little patch of Lucy's brain from an early experiment I was doing on the dynamics of brain tissue. And brain tissue is really rather like heart tissue. Except that the hearts are meant to beat in nice neat rhythms, and brains are meant to fibrillate and have heart attacks. But fundamentally they're the same kind of thing. And so this is a piece of Lucy's brain behaving like the heart, just rhythmically bouncing in and out. It's actually 1,024 little oscillators flicking backwards and forwards in their own way. But they're loosely coupled to their neighbours, and so when their neighbours flip backwards and forwards, that slightly disturbs what they do. And gradually they all fall into synchrony, and you get this heart beating. But if you randomise it, if you kick all the oscillators at random, what really interests me about it is it always settles down into this little shape, this mushroom generator shape. It produces black mushrooms and white mushrooms, and no matter how many times you do it, it always settles down into the mushroom generators, and I have no idea why. But I do know that there are similar things going on in the brain, and a lot of other excitable media. But I just thought that was rather pretty, and I'd show you for the aesthetics of it. and hopefully it will lead into Brian's bit now.
Well, thank you.
Actually, it leads in very, very well. We didn't rehearse this before, but my interest in cybernetics and complex systems really stemmed from some musical experiences. In the 60s, I was part of a sort of scene of people who were involved in the Scratch Orchestra and with Cornelius Cardew and with various new forms of composition that really worked in a different way from classical composition. For a start, they didn't require skilled performers, which is why I could be involved with them. But they also didn't involve conductors, and they often didn't involve anything that resembled a traditional composer. They were ways of making music sort of from the bottom up rather than from the top down. You know, the classical image of the composer is of someone who sort of has the vision of the piece in their mind, and then they carefully sculpt it and write it down so that other sort of semi-automatons with musical instruments can bring it into being, as though the piece sort of pre-existed its physical representation. I noticed that most of the music I enjoyed wasn't being produced this way. And one particular piece fascinated me. It was by the composer Cornelius Cardew. And it was called Paragraph 7 of The Great Learning. I won't go into it at length here, but suffice it to say that it was rather similar to this kind of experience. It was a piece with very few rules, written for any group of singers, so it could be this room full of people. It thrived on having tone-deaf singers as well as good singers. It thrived on the variety of any random group of people. And the rules were very, very simple, and they weren't musical rules in the sense that they didn't say anything musically specific. There are only three rules. But what was interesting about this piece is that it always had the same identity in performance. It was always recognizable as that piece of music. And given the looseness of the system, of the description, this was a real puzzle to me. I thought, how can something, just as you're wondering how this always becomes mushrooms, how did this piece of music always become essentially the same piece of music? I've performed it 10 or 12 times with completely different groups of people. I did it once with 6,000 people in San Francisco. I did it with 6,000 people at Watford School of Art. Essentially, the piece remains the same. So I started to wonder how something that has identity can be formed or can form itself from very simple initial instructions. I wrote a long essay about that piece, which is published if anyone's interested, and I won't go into it now. But it got me into the idea of thinking that if we want to make complex systems, the best way to do it is not to design them from the top down, not to think them out and then try to engineer them, but to somehow let them emerge from the bottom up. There's something you say in this book about what Steve's doing, which is actually very nicely put, I think. Grand is using tiny, concurrent, thoughtless interactions to make Lucy walk and talk. And since he's an engineer and not a scientist, he's trying to understand these new forms of life from the bottom up by building them rather than by taking them apart. Now, this idea of suggesting that one could think of musical composition in this way, and not only musical composition, but composition of visual, textual, and even social and economic ideas, and architecture, and finally everything else, it started to impress me more and more that this was, in fact, the way that complex things came into being. About 15 years ago, I ran into this lovely book by Jane Jacobs called, I think it's called Death and Life in the American City, where she was actually writing a book that was against city planning because she lived in Greenwich Village, which was just about to be destroyed to put a highway through it, and it was being destroyed because it was an unplanned community. And in the 30s, when this was happening, or the 20s, planning was the big idea in cities. What she wrote was that actually it's far from an unplanned community. It's actually a very well organized community, but we call it unplanned because we didn't consciously organize it. We don't know how the organization came about. Now, throughout this century, or the last century, I should say, and into this one, people, I think, have become more and more aware of the possibility that there might be processes that are smarter than we are. That's to say that we can instigate processes, and that they can carry themselves through, and that they can come up with results that we couldn't predict, and results that we often can't understand. Now, this has been the experience a lot of people working with neural networks, that they've been able to, for instance, teach a neural network to recognize the difference between a male and a female in a photograph. And they've been able to make the photographs increasingly fuzzy to the point where humans could no longer recognize the differences. But the neural nets still can. They're more accurate now than humans at doing this. And the most interesting thing to me is that we don't know how they're doing it. We don't know what the internal structure of the neural net is or how it has arrived at that basis of evaluation. When I started making what I called ambient music, my impulse was to try to make a form of music that I couldn't predict. What I wanted to do was not to be a Mozart and to have a fully realized composition in my head which would then appear magically in the world. What I wanted to do was to make machines, basically, that would produce music and would produce that music endlessly. Well, at that time I was making records which weren't by any means endless. So my pieces produced themselves endlessly for 30 minutes. And you hear the same 30 minutes over and over. But now things are different. There exist some technologies, one in particular that I've been working with a lot, called Koan, which is essentially a compositional tool. And what I can do with that is put in sets of rules, but they're rather vague rules. They're probabilistic rules. I can say, stay within this harmonic language and occasionally visit these extreme reaches of it. Stay within this rhythmic language and occasionally visit these extreme reaches. I can then, it takes a long time to design these seeds. That's essentially what I'm doing now as a composer. I'm not making forests, I'm making seeds. Then pressing go is letting the forest grow, seeing what I get. Now, of course, with all of these things, in a sense, they're to do with evolution and evolutionary ideas. And the question is, well, what is the fitness landscape? What are these things being tested against? Well, obviously, they're being tested against my taste. Where I differ from the artists of the 60s who were thrilled by systems and who thought that they were in some way unimpeachable and sacred. So having set the system, Cage, for instance, having set the system in motion would not exercise censorship on what happened to it. I'm actually more interested in being the fitness landscape, in saying, okay, set this thing in motion. That one I like. Now, why do I like it, and how do I make more of that kind of thing? This one I don't like, so I'll forget it. So, in a sense, he's talking about being a fitness landscape as well for Lucy. Obviously, Lucy is not just producing random behaviors. He's interested in particular behaviors that it might produce. One last thing, comment I want to make. What you were talking about is very much to do with increasing the scope of the senses, and that has indeed always been what we've used technology for. What I'm interested in now, however, is the possibility that these tools actually increase the scope of our imaginations. They make it possible to imagine things that really were not possible before. I have for a few years been particularly interested in cellular automata. These are very simple rule-based processes which produce extremely surprising results. Steve demonstrated one here once, and in my talk here last year I showed a couple. What they tell me is that our intuitions about complex systems are very, very primitive. We don't have good intuitions about complexity. We don't have good intuitions about scale variation, for instance. We tend to think that something bigger is more of the same. One of the lessons of complex systems is that something bigger is nearly always something different. And I suppose I'm interested as an artist in exploring these things, because I think one of the things that art does is rehearse your intuitions. It helps you develop new ones, and in those areas, in the sense of complex systems, which is after all where we live, in increasingly complex ones, we really need better intuitions. So that's all I'll say now.
Thanks very much.
For keeping to time.
Did I?
You did very well.
It's from making singles.
So one of the things that people have always liked about neural networks, it seems to me, is that they can't understand what they're doing. And so there is a sort of fallacy, which I think all of us who've worked in this area have thought of, which is that we don't understand how the brain works, and we don't understand how this neural network we've built just now works, and so maybe they're doing the same thing. Now, what it seems to me lies behind that question is really about control. And so what interests me about your work is that on the one hand, you're sort of letting these things go and do their own stuff. But on the other hand, you can get blocked and puzzled when you don't understand what's happening. So you're using these self-organizing things, as it were, to give you cues to things that you might not have otherwise understood. But you still want to be God. You're in fact not willing to let the thing go. And in a similar sense, the music, I mean, a person can compose a piece and get people to perform it. But it's even more powerful if whatever people want to do, they'll still be singing this person's work. I mean, that's real control. These people cannot even want to be making the same piece of music, and it will always come out sounding the same. So isn't there a kind of illusion here that you say that you're giving up control and letting the computer take over, but actually it's a form of meta-control, way of imposing yourself even more hard on the material that you're working with?
Do you want to answer that?
I think meta-control is a good word for it. That idea that you should just let it get on with it, and if it doesn't work out, then it's not your fault, is it? Is what I call chuck it in a bucket science. But, you know, you just throw a load of neurons into a bucket and stir, and if it doesn't turn into a brain, it's not your fault, is it? The kind of stuff that I think Brian and I were talking about is more skillful than that. Allowing something to emerge, not interfering too much to stop it from emerging, and yet still having some kind of understanding at a meta level of what's likely to happen, what might happen, how to encourage it to happen, I think is a skill that none of us has very well yet, but we need to learn it.
Can I add something to that? You know, I do want to make things, and I want to make the things that I want to hear. That's always been the only reason I've made music, because it didn't already exist, what I want to hear. So, but it turns out that what I want to hear is beyond what I can predict. Do you see what I mean? It's not already in there. I have an idea of how it might be made, how it might come into being, but I can't imagine what it is. So more and more I find myself in the area of trying to construct the processes by which it will come into being. This previous slide, you had build the brain or build the mind as the two separate ambitions. Well, a lot of the history of early electronic music was sort of imitative, you know, like the famous switched on Bach, the idea that we can use all these instruments and it still sounds like Bach, which seemed to me so utterly pointless, really. Whereas what I want to do is to say, can I make the music I want to hear without knowing what it is beforehand, without pre-imagining it? You know, can I make a new music from in this way, or a new art, if you like?
But artists are often notoriously bad at explaining what's good about their own work. I mean, if you've ever...
Nearly always.
You know, especially visual artists and perhaps even writers. And so, in fact, there's nothing new about not knowing how the thing that you've produced came about. Mm-hmm. And I guess would you agree? And similarly with the biology? I mean, that just because you don't understand the bits inside Lucy doesn't mean she's smarter than a program which you do know about the bits.
Tricky subject. The thing that interests me about emergence in relation to the brain is that the mind is an emergent construct from the brain. That doesn't mean that the brain is some kind of vague mishmash. It's a very organized structure, as you know. And what's more, it's a self-organizing structure. And I think it's perfectly possible to understand, I've forgotten what the question was now, but it's perfectly possible to understand the substrate and yet still be surprised at the results.
Yeah.
Well, this is the lesson of cellular automata, I think. It's the simplest way of seeing that point. You know, you set in motion this very simple game. It's got three little rules. They're very easy to understand. Nothing surprising can happen, you think. And you put one dot in a different place and press go, and suddenly there's flowers and cosmic explosions for 15,800 generations. And you think, how did that happen? The rules didn't change. Nothing changed, except I moved that dot one place to the right. You know, so it's just a set of intuitions that we don't have. We don't understand sensitivity to initial conditions as a kind of given in our psyche.
It seems like, as you pointed out, Brian, the only really interesting things are complex systems, and the way that we can apprehend complex systems is through our brain, which is also itself a complex system. Mm-hmm. But it seems that in a way you have to stand back and watch it happen, or let it happen, and you still don't understand it, which is essentially what Steve is doing in trying to create his lucid brain. He's not building it from the top down. The scientific method that you're applying is more akin to artistic intuition than it is to traditional scientific method, mm-hmm. where you know exactly what's going on, and you measure precisely how much of material A you add to material B to get the result C. Is it not possible that when we're dealing with brains, we have to, in our approach to understanding them, we have to adopt their language, which is emergence, which is more, as I said, more an approach that artists take in not fully understanding what they're doing, but following a certain thread? Is it not, in effect, the artistic intuition, the proper scientific method to apply to what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm probably an artist in what I do more than a scientist. This whole word, word emergence, I've never heard a satisfactory definition of the term, and everyone seems to have a different view. Surprise seems to be key to emergence, but I proffer a technical definition for your benefit, which is that in an emergent system is perfectly deterministic, but the only way to predict what it will do is to run the system. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily run it in reality. You can run it in a model in your head. You can think it through. But the only way you'll understand an emergent system is to actually go through the process that it would have to go through. And that's it, like the game of life. Mm-hmm. You get this glider thing that moves across the screen. There's nothing surprising about it once you've seen it. You can see why it happens. But the only way to predict its existence is to actually run the game in your head and figure it out. So you know, there's nothing magical about emergence. It's only different in the sense that it's not immediately obvious. You can't find mathematical ways to get at what it is.
I think it does have some. We should open the thing to questions.
We're okay for a little while. We'll,
can I just just say something on that question of control, because that seems to be something that vexes people a lot about this subject, about whether we're passing control over to, you know, we're losing control of these creatures we're making, or whether we've surrendered, or whether we're putting too much control. The issue of control is really at the center of this in a way, and a lot of it is to do that with accepting that with very complex systems you can't know their states, you can't know their internal states, and you can't predict precisely, except as Steve said, by running them, you can't predict their futures. Now, of course, we have a whole history of believing that the universe acts in a different way. You know, we have a kind of Newtonian paradigm that says, if you knew all the initial conditions, you'd be able to... Well, it's true with the game of life, actually. If you knew all the initial conditions, and if you could somehow hold that intuition in your head, you could predict its future state. But actually, you don't. It's impossibly difficult to do. And that's a very simple example. You know, it's certainly multiplied a million times in anything that you're likely to happen across across in real life.
How would you know if you'd succeeded, Stephen? In some ways in your book, you set down what seemed to be quite reasonable, but also quite simple criteria. For example, you say something is alive if it's reproducing and if it's metabolizing. And up to a point, if you've designed it to do those things, then you can say it's alive because it's doing those things, and that's the definition. Do you think that you would ever be able to know whether the things that you're building are intelligent, except by setting these arbitrary criteria and then being able to see that the system is actually doing that?
Intelligent, yes. Whether consciousness would be the one that I can't know how I would know if something was conscious.
Mm-hmm.
There just doesn't seem to be a solution to that.
But you're still motivated to try and build one. I mean, even though you wouldn't know if you succeeded.
Yeah, I would just see how far I can get. That's the thing. And, you know, I infer that you're conscious, and it's not a big problem to me to infer that. If we could get far enough with a robot, then most people would be happy to infer that it was conscious if it behaved in certain ways, and that's good enough for me.
Well, there's a sort of Turing test thing going
on,
isn't there? And there is with, I think, with music as well. You know, I now have systems that make music that people think is indistinguishable from everything else I do. They say, yeah, it just sounds like you. But in fact, it's made in an entirely different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the thing about the Turing test that people forget to point out is that you can't win it. You can't pass it. You can only ever fail it. You know, a machine can fail to look like a human being, but to succeed it has to look like a human being forever.
Yeah, there's no termination criterion, which is actually true. Do any of the people that you met for your book, are they fooled by their bionic senses? Does it seem real to them, do you think? Or are they all clearly being fed stuff that is just a substitute?
No, they are. The people who have implants are all completely enamored of the devices. The woman that I was describing with the implant in her optic nerve, she says, she's had very major brain surgery to have this device installed in her head, and she's still involved in weekly experiments at the laboratory. So she's made, and she's 63, so she's made a lot of personal sacrifices to have this, but she says, it's become a part of me. And she was so distraught. She was 57 when she became blind, and she was so distraught by that experience, having lost her sight after having lived for 57 years with being able to see. Imagine it if you suddenly lost your sight, that she was willing to undergo this still very experimental procedure, and she's got rather sophisticated hardware in her head. But she says, I don't even think about it anymore, and even if I'm only able to perceive light and shadows or basic shapes again, it would have been worth it. And there are not many people who have these kind of things in their bodies at this point, but I talked to about a half a dozen of them, and they all share the same view. Some are paralyzed, some are blind, some are deaf. They all say, it's part of me, it's part of my body now, and it's a part of my body that I value really highly because it's restoring my sensory ability again. So there's no kind of psychosis about the presence of the technology in the body at all.
Should we take some questions? Does anyone have anything they want to ask? Yeah.
You talked about augmenting the body and in contrast emulating the mind and spirit. What about augmenting the mind and spirit beyond just delivering information through our existing senses, beyond even the intuitions that Brian Neal was touching upon? What about a real, you know, knowledge upload, understanding straight into our brain, whole foreign thoughts, memories not our own, like in total recall,
mm-hmm.
or even finally, you know, enlightenment, like Nirvana on a ship, things like that.
I buy it.
Sounds great. No, really. You know, one always thinks of the problem of learning languages, for example. Wouldn't it be so marvelous to be able to speak languages easily? But the technical problems involved with this are so complex, partly because we don't understand memory at all well. I think that's one of the biggest problems. I mean, you may have done some work in this direction, I don't know.
I wouldn't have a clue where to start.
No.
It's quite a scary thought, because you are your memories, and I wouldn't want to suddenly be somebody else. The only reason when I wake up in the morning I know who I am is because I remember who I was the day before, and it's those memories that make me continuous, even though my body's being replaced continually, even my brain's being replaced continually, molecule by molecule.
What about if somebody came up with a way of implanting memories much more efficiently? Like, I remember a quack thing that was going on years ago when these little circular trampolines came out, at-home trampolines for exercise, and the guy selling them wrote this book where he claimed that you learned much faster if you read while you're on the trampoline, because there was some kind of compression of something in your brain that sort of pushed it in quicker. You know? And I did indeed see people trying to read physics books.
There's a bit in the early part of the question though, which I'm interested in, which is the notion of hyperreality. I mean, if you consider that current prosthetic devices give you an impoverished view of the world, so that's at one end of the continuum, and our current sense, how we see or hear or smell or touch, is here, isn't it imaginable that with implanted sensing devices, we could actually get beyond our current sensor abilities and get to...
That was something that really interested me. Something James said in his book was with these retinal implants, that maybe one day we'll be able to use them to augment our ordinary senses and be able to see in the ultraviolet. And I thought, what colour is ultraviolet? What would it feel like to see ultraviolet? And when you start to think about it, the biology of it, what you have to do to the cones in our retina and the signals going to the brain, there's some really deep puzzles in there about qualia.
Yeah. I think to just follow up on your question a little bit, there's nothing theoretically impossible to what you say. It's just, as Brian said, it's the technical difficulties at this point are very, very high. But it's analogous in a way to the sense of smell. The sense of smell and the sense of taste are extremely poorly understood. We really don't have a very refined idea of how smells and tastes are perceived. But they're perceived through smell and taste receptors. Now, there's currently work going on to one of the devices you'll see later to transmit smells through the internet and things like that. But in fact, you don't really need an actual smell to generate the perception of a smell in the human brain. All that you need to do are to activate the appropriate receptors. For example, if I wanted to smell this lemon, I just need to identify which receptors in my nose are activated by the smell of the lemon. And if I stimulated those receptors electronically in the absence of an actual lemon, I would still experience that smell, because the smell, it sounds paradoxical, but the smell really has nothing to do with the presence of the lemon. It's the electrical signals that have been transmitted to my brain from the receptors. Mm-hmm. Now, you could also do this with memories, or learning a language, or having a particular physical experience, or having a particular mental or emotional experience. In fact, there's a gentleman in the United States who claims he can generate a religious experience in anyone who comes to his laboratory. He's got this magnetic thing, and he just activates it and applies it to a certain area of your brain, and many people report having seen God. In the absence of the actual divinity itself, obviously. So, this is what I was trying to get at in my original remarks. The difference between virtual reality and reality, there's really no difference, because ultimately what we're experiencing are a lot of electrical signals and chemicals squishing around in our brains. And if you can flick on the appropriate switches, you can recreate those sensations or those memories or that knowledge, and it would be just as real as if you spent 20 years learning French, the end result at least.
It's worth bearing in mind how many switches you have to flick.
Well, that's the technical difficulty, but this is my attempt to make chuck it in a bucket science.
Does that thing work on atheists?
It's an excellent idea. We should have conduct a
test.
Let's have a couple of questions. We'll try and take them together.
you were about to ask a question.
There was still a part where you asked, it seems to be a very popular analogy, especially in the years. Looking at the people in the past, and I've always thought of the structure based on our visual means. And it seems to be almost an integrated part of us to actually structure ideas according to visual terms and rules. And to some degree, I mean, maybe that's sort of the problem, that we actually construct ideas based on visual language. Whereas, you know, the rules that apply, for example, smell or anything, I mean, the whole categorization of senses itself applies actually 1 to 2.5 million old. And if you study animal senses, you can actually test quite a few more of these.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, maybe the problem is that they're just asked the wrong questions, so I have the questions in the wrong language.
We're too dominated by vision.
Well, I think I think this is one, some of the things you can experience after the talk address your point, because they're bringing, you're absolutely right, for since computers have been around, they've been primarily a visual medium, and only recently have become also an oral medium. But now there are machines in which you can actually feel objects inside a computer. You can actually feel information, or you can have that information taken directly into your body, or you can smell it, or you can taste it. There's even a company that claims they can print out on a little rice cracker any flavor through a computer. So if you click on a menu, you know, an Indian menu, and want to taste what the curry tastes like before you order it, it'll be printed out on a rice cracker. So I think there's a real opportunity here to engage the other senses, which, if you think about it, in daily life, smell is incredibly important. And it rarely reaches the level of consciousness. Only if there's a very prominent, pleasant or unpleasant smell do you become aware of it. But it influences your moods, your behaviors, your state of mind. So I think there's a real, especially in the field of entertainment, there's a real opportunity to bring back smell-o-vision.
Should there be a committee of ethics that would look at what should be and what should be determined in science? It sounds very sexy and fire-like, but
I think we need a committee of ethics with 5 billion people in it. It's about time we all sorted out our ideas about our moral stance and our ethical stance towards life, towards, you know, abortion or cloning or whatever. And we've ducked the questions for a long time. They're essentially the same questions. If you're talking about, you know, my field, artificial life, as far as I'm concerned, artificial life is just life. There's no fundamental distinction between natural and artificial life forms. So all artificial life forms do is bring the ethical questions out into the open and shock us into thinking about them, which is a good thing. So I think we've just sort of clutched the issue, avoided these questions for a long time. It's about time we face them. But I think it's a question for all of us rather than a committee.
Could you imagine ever having difficulty switching Lucy off?
I know, she's very easy to switch off.
But in generations, her great-great-great-great-granddaughter.
Yes, but it's not as scary as it sounds. Chris Langton, who coined the term artificial life back in 1987, part of his definition of life is autonomy, that creatures are only alive if they have control of their own destiny, and I agree with that. So you have to try to get to the point where you can't switch them off. But life forms are life forms. You know, I can't switch tigers off and it doesn't worry me. if somebody went to the jungles of Borneo and came back with a new species of primate next week, I wouldn't think, oh my God, are they going to take over the world? These questions trouble us about machines, but the reasons for that are quite strange and interesting. I mean, you know, mostly it's science fiction that generates this fear in us.
I think the point about your question that interests me is that the sort of unspoken truth about a lot of this science is that it's mostly owned by defence departments. You know, I think it's now true that 50% of British research scientists work for defence. That's a huge investment of talent into an area that basically we aren't allowed to criticise or participate in any way whatsoever. And I'm sure the ratio is about the same in America. And so, yeah. Well, the reason governments like military spending is because it's the place where they can have a socialist economy in the middle of a free enterprise system. You can hose money in any direction you want. Nobody can criticize you. They don't know about it because it's all secret. So you can support all sorts of exotic research and keep Ford going and Boeing going and everything else under the rubric of military spending. But of course, military spending turns out to have consequences. You know, it's not just a way of keeping the economy going. And one of the consequences at the moment that we're looking at is the complete militarization of space by the United States. Completely undiscussed topic. You know, what does missile defense mean? It means that we're going to control the world by controlling space. Now, why is this not being discussed all the time? Why are we watching pissing sport on television? I believe sport is designed to absorb the creative and revolutionary energies of people and waste them, basically.
It's quite pleasantly ironic that the laser was invented as a death ray, and although it has applications in space, one of the things that no one predicted was that it couldn't get through water vapour. And so it must be very frustrating for all the defence scientists trying to make the killing rays to discover the main consequence as being CD players. So there are examples.
Yes.
Any more questions? Yeah.
The question is really regarding Lucy. It's fascinating about embodiment, but given that you're giving Lucy a neural network from which she can progress from, and all the sensory cores to place her in her environment, she would probably grow up without any concept of mortality in the way that we or anybody else can do. How does that shape that neural network or her sort of personality, character, mortality, whatever you want to call it, being fundamentally different to all of us? The one thing that can join every person on the planet is their mortality. Obviously, with technology moving where it is, you know, power access, etc., for losing in the future won't be a problem. How do you see that affecting world of embodiment and artificial intelligence?
That's a good question, and I don't really have an answer to it. I don't know what it's like to be immortal, so I can't really imagine. I mean, in practice, Lucy won't be aware of anything, let alone her mortality or lack of it, because she's going to be too stupid. And she'll have a brain with 100,000 neurons in as opposed to 100,000 million. But potentially in the future, artificial life forms will be immortal, but also potentially in the future, so will we. I should think it's probably a race to see who gets there first. My money would be on human beings. We'd probably crack the genetic problems of becoming immortal quicker than we crack the problems of intelligence. But
my money would be on 4-star generals.
Can you say a word about copying? Because, I mean, one of the appeals of the idea of understanding where knowledge is, it relates perhaps to the question of uploading. But, I mean, immortality could be obtained. As you say, we are all regenerated in terms of our atoms all the time, if we could be uploaded. And certainly that's going to be an advantage which artificial life forms will have over us.
Yes. It's a very disturbing and difficult subject, copying, because there seems to be a completely different law at work inside cyberspace. In physical space, the fundamental law of physics is you can't copy stuff, you can just move it. In cyberspace, the law is completely reversed. You can copy anything you like for free, but you can't move something. Which means that if you could upload yourself into a computer, you could do it an infinite number of times, and there'd be an infinite number of you. You can't achieve immortality by that means. You can only spawn somebody else who achieves immortality. I mean, I'd still be here. I'd be really pissed off. I copied my mind into a computer and he was going to live forever and I wasn't.
But there are many, many, chuck it in a bucket, scientists who claim that you can use this kind of technology to essentially record your entire life. You know, everything it's possible. You can record everything, smells and tastes and what you saw and what you heard. And then somehow, and this is the tricky part, somehow record the brain states that correspond to those experiences and upload that somewhere and thus achieve immortality. But I think Steve's right. It wouldn't be him. I don't even think it would be a living thing. It would essentially be a very, very sophisticated home video in which all the senses were engaged. But it wouldn't have that vital spark, which we don't know what that is in our own brains.
Well,
so
I disagree with that, James. depends on how you do it. It depends on whether what you're making is a portrait. You know, just the superficial image of who you were. But if you take a thought experiment that I write about in my book, where you create a computer model of physics at the quantum level, you have a huge database of the dispositions of all the atoms in this model, and you arrange those atoms in the shape of a clock, this virtual clock will tick. Right? If you then were capable of rearranging those atoms in the shape of you, it would think. And I can't see any reason why it would not believe it was you. I would know I was still here. But he would be convinced that he was me and had suddenly been transported into the computer.
Would you believe he was you, though?
I'd have no option to believe what he said. it's a very strange and hard thought experiment to deal with, but I don't think there is a vital spark, and I think if you did it right, there really would be a you inside this cyberspace.
Right. I think I agree. The point I'm trying to make is that it would not be a way for you to achieve immortality.
No, you can't escape.
Whatever
you can't duplicate that.
Whatever you created would either be alive or not alive, but it wouldn't be you, and it wouldn't be an avenue through which to escape death.
Yeah. And you can't get around it by the cheating methods that some people like Dan Dennett do, which is to copy your brain one neuron at a time and then destroy the neuron you just copied. So you end up with a virtual copy and lo and behold, no biological being left. Mm-hmm. And that looks like you're moving someone, but what you're actually doing is murdering someone slowly.
Two more questions. Which I will supply both of. Well, I have a question about something like art, and the question is something like, there are many things that we can communicate in words and we can think about, but it seems that appreciation of artistic creations requires much more sensory input. So, for example, looking at a picture of something in the National Gallery, we say, is never quite the same as being there. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's something important about the way in which intelligence is embodied that's exploited by artistic endeavour?
Well, the first thing I'd say about looking at or listening to any artwork is that we never listen to just it. We also hear our whole history of experiences like that, you know. I mean, the best example is, I gave a talk once where I told about some archaeologists in 10,000 years' time who've found a box, and they open it and there's a thing in there. They take it out and they look at it and they say, oh God, it must have faded. But actually what they're looking at is Kazimir Malevich's White on White. Well, I use that example because that was a fundamentally radical moment in the history of art. But it was only a moment because of what had happened before it. If you didn't know the story that led up to that painting, it doesn't make any sense. It's effectively a blank canvas. And I think all of our art experiences are like that. You know, that's why some of them can be very minimal and very disturbing, because they aren't simply that. They're that tweak on a whole history of experiences like that. So it is possible to just do the little tweak, and that's very effective and economical when people do that. I like that kind of work. So what I think happens when we look at things is that we bring a history of perceptions and expectations, and then we try to fit them onto, or we try to fit that new experience into them, and some way or another it differs, and that difference is what we're looking at. That difference is the whole charge of the thing. All the ways it's the same are some kind of reaffirmation, but the way it's different is the message, really. So this brings up a whole argument about art, which actually I find one of the most interesting, because all traditional theories of art assumed that the value of the art object was intrinsic to it, you know, that somehow the artist put qualities into something by sculpting it or whatever he was doing. So that thing now had radiated this thing called art at it, which is why missionaries thought that playing gramophone records of Bach to natives would make them behave more like decent English people. Or Germans, actually. But if you think, no, it isn't like that, but actually the value of a work is something that we confer on it. This is simply a trigger, you know, this is a sort of matrix that you can confer onto. That seems to be much more like the right model for how that works.
So Steve, is there any connection between aesthetics and intelligence in your work? And can you imagine your automata starting to appreciate art? Would that be an important thing?
I just dream of such things. I should be happy if she can reach out and pick something up.
But is enjoyment of senses an important early building block? I'm trying to understand why intelligence, you strongly argue, can only come about in an embodied environment with senses, and I'm wondering if the enjoyment of sensation, the touch of something, or the smell of
something,
is important.
That's definitely a motivating factor in young babies, and curiosity is characteristic of the human species. And
reward too. You know, you've evolved to be rewarded for making the right choices. You know, that fruit tastes nice, so I eat it. That piece of poo doesn't, so I don't.
There are some deep questions in there about poo. About why music isn't poo. Why do we appreciate music when you can't easily see an evolutionary reason for it? Some kind of epiphenomenon.
Yeah, yeah. I think for the reason I was just trying to explain, that you live in a landscape of signs, you know, and you're very, very aware of the weight and value and charge of those signs. And when someone does something a little bit different with them, it really makes a difference. I mean, why does language make any sense to us? You know, it's not, language isn't less mysterious than music. It's just a bit more sharp.
Well, except in as much as you can see why we have language. Mm-hmm. So it's not so easy to see why music evolved, why our brains seem to appreciate melody and...
Well, it's easy to see why singing evolved, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to see why people would respond to the state of somebody's voice, because there are so many messages in a voice, quite separate from the words they happen to carry. So it's easy to see that, first of all, people... In fact, one might imagine that people use their voice musically before they used it verbally. Do you know what I mean? It's probably the earliest way of using the voice in some sort of musical way. To go, you know, these sort of things do have meaning. So if you can see why the voice as a would have a musical value to it, then I think all other instruments are comprehensible from that somehow.
Conjures up a wonderful image of the primeval jungle, doesn't it? The hills are alive with the sound of music.
The sound of grunting.
I wonder if any of the people with prosthetics can take aesthetic pleasure through their prosthetic eye or through their prosthetic ear.
Well, that's a good question. Yeah.
Mm. That is a good question. Certainly not at this stage, but the people who, the example I gave you can change your environment with, it's not an implant in your body, but it's something that you can wear and have images projected onto your eyes. You can change your aesthetic environment, whether it's walking in the down the street or at home, and you can you can determine what you see at any given moment. The other interesting thing is, and this touches on some of your ethical questions, is that alternatively you could let someone else control your environment. So for example, if you were wearing one of these glasses that could project images directly onto your retina, you could, I'm talking about control, you could give someone else control of the images that are being projected onto your retina at any given time. And I've used some of these devices, and the projection is absolutely realistic. You cannot distinguish it. It doesn't seem vaporous or unreal in any way. It's very, very concrete, and it's very, very there. I think there's a whole realm of artistic expression here whereby individuals could give over their sensory, their entire sensory experience to an artist or to someone else, who could then determine everything they hear and see and smell and taste and touch at any given moment. You could turn that over to an artist, or you could turn that over to a government, for example, which brings us back to the military question.
Which is the much more likely route.
Which is definitely the likely route.
They'll use it to sell sport as well. Be able to smell the sweat.
Right, last question, very brief.
The monkeys are research animals, so they are being used for this these experiments with the explicit aim of developing implants for the use of people like the woman I described. So the researcher who is carrying this work out, he's not working for the military. At least he didn't admit to me that he was, but then he probably wouldn't. He's trying to develop implants that blind people could use, deaf people could use. I think the first application will be people who are paralyzed, so that essentially he wants to build a parallel nervous system inside their bodies, and that's the work, that's the goal of the work on the monkeys. So it's not some kind of sinister thing, unless you think animal experimentation is sinister. The monkeys themselves don't know that they can operate the robotic arm because they don't have any sensory feedback. They don't actually see it. And I think that's the crucial next stage of the experiment, I think, would address your point. The next year or the next couple months, he wants to create feedback to the monkeys so that when the robotic arm actually reaches out and touches a banana, the monkeys would have sensors on their fingers so that they would actually feel, not the sensation of a banana necessarily, but they would feel that they're touching something. And they would actually see the robotic arm move and touch the banana. That's how we know that we have limbs, because we can see and feel what they do in the world, and that's how our brain recognizes them. He wants to try to recreate that in the monkeys. And the next stage after that is to try to get the monkeys to keep their own biological limbs still and just think about reaching for the banana and have the robotic arm go out and reach for the banana. That's the crucial thing for getting these implants to work in victims of paralysis, because they can't, because of the injury to their spinal cord, they can't move their own arms. But they still can think about it. They can think about moving their arm.
Great, well, thanks very much. I have two fantasies about how we'll meet again in 10 years. One will be a raffle that you, at the end of the evening, will have to decide which one of us was actually an automaton and which of them were human. And the other is you'll probably actually be at home and it will be beamed directly into your brains, and so you won't have the inconvenience. In the meantime, anyway, I'd like to thank all of you for coming and like you to thank the speakers for their attention. As Rachel mentioned, there are demonstrations next door which you're all very welcome to go and play with.